Okay. It is November 2nd, 2010, and we are interviewing Mr. Neil Kashkari. Mr. Kashkari, my name is Chris Seifer. I'm with the FCIC. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report by the end of this year. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. As we talked about a little before we threw on the recording device, the first thing I'd like you to do, please, is just summarize your educational and work background since college, and then we'll get to the substance.
Sure. Thank you. It's my pleasure to speak with you today. I did my bachelor's and master's in mechanical engineering at the University of Illinois in Urbana. I then worked for about 3 years as an aerospace engineer at what was then TRW Corporation, that's now part of Northrop Grumman, working on NASA space missions. After that, I went back to business school, went to Wharton, where I got my MBA at the University of Pennsylvania, graduating in 2002. I then joined Goldman Sachs, where I was a technology investment banker, doing mergers and acquisitions and financings for tech companies in Silicon Valley, until July 2006, when I joined the Treasury Department as first senior advisor to Treasury Secretary Paulson, and then later as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, and I was at Treasury until May 2009. I then took about 6 months off, and I eventually joined PIMCO, where I am now as a managing director and head of new investment initiatives, PIMCO in Newport Beach, California.
Okay, thank you. So when you joined Treasury as a senior advisor to Secretary Paulson in July of 06, then you said became assistant secretary. Do you recall the timing of when you became assistant secretary?
Yes, I was confirmed by the Senate, I believe, in July of 2008, so 2 years after I joined Treasury. I had been nominated, I believe it was October, November 2007, and it took about 6 or 7 months before I had a hearing to get confirmed.
Okay. And then can you just generally describe the circumstances that led to your joining Treasury in July of 06?
Sure. I had always had an interest in government, and when then CEO of our firm, Henry Paulson, was picked to be Treasury Secretary by President Bush, I basically called him up. I met him once before and said, look, I want to come with you. I'm very interested in learning about government. I want to help in any way that I can. And, you know, as luck would have it, he brought me with him, and I started with him the same day he started.
Okay. And at least in one of the books I've read, you fly out to D.C., and he offers you the job on the spot.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. He made a few calls. You know, did some reference checking on very senior people at the firm who knew me, and they spoke highly of me. And so when I actually went to see him, he was selling me more than I was selling him.
Okay.
So it surprised me.
So what was, generally, to the extent you recall, what was he telling you in July of 06, one, and two, what I want to do after that is have you generally describe for me what your job responsibilities were when you joined in July of 06?
Sure. He said he wanted to put together a small policy team to work on a range of policy issues that are very important to him. It would be doing everything from researching policies, coming up with policy proposals, helping to implement policies, just do whatever needs to get done. And basically said, how does that sound? And to me, that sounded like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Right.
And I didn't have a preference on what policy issues I worked on. I really just wanted to get an experience to understand how our federal government works and to learn about the policy process. So it sounded like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, which is what I told him. When I got to Treasury, he started out by having me work on energy policy. He cares a lot about energy, as it's well known. He cares a lot about the environment and is a big advocate for alternative energy. So I started by developing a project for him and jointly for his counterpart in the White House, who at the time was a guy named Al Hubbard, who was, director of the National Economic Council. So for the next 6 months, I worked jointly for Hank and for Al, developing a program to encourage the investment in alternative energy, and ultimately presented that plan to President Bush, who ultimately backed the plan, and we ended up getting a lot of what we asked for passed through Congress in an Energy Act in 2007. I can't remember the title of the act now. Maybe it was the Energy Security Act of 2007, but it was a big push on alternative energy and alternative fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of the key policy person helping to drive that process.
So when did you start? That sounds all very interesting, but I don't think the whole energy policy issues probably have much to do with the financial crisis. Tell me if
Correct.
You think I'm mistaken in that regard.
Nope.
So tell me when you start working on issues that were more related to the financial crisis.
So in the summer of 2007, so we'd been at Treasury for about a year, we were seeing real stress and strains in the housing market, and around August 07, he asked me to lead the department's work on housing. Now, even though I didn't know anything about housing at the time, to be honest with you, no one else at Treasury knew anything about housing at the time, and I had demonstrated to him that I could figure out a complex issue and come up with reasonable policy options and try to get them implemented. So I led a task force at Treasury to get very smart on housing as quickly as we could, working across the administration, both with the White House and with the Housing and Urban Development, to understand what were the problems in the housing market and, more importantly, what could we do about it. And that ultimately led to our first intervention of sorts, which was, well, a couple things. One is we formed a group bringing housing counselors together with mortgage servicers, and they created a nonprofit group called Hope Now as a way to try to reach homeowners to encourage loan modifications. That was one of the first things that we did. Following that, in December 2007, we rolled out a plan. We had negotiated with investors and with the mortgage servicers to freeze rates that were going to reset. So as you probably know, all these subprimes, these 228 and 327 loans, had a teaser rate for 2 or 3 years and then would pop up after 2 or 3 years. And there was a real fear that when they popped up, that it would trigger a lot of defaults and foreclosures. And we negotiated with the industry that freezing those rates was better than letting them reset and go into foreclosure. And that was December 2007. So that was our first major intervention of sorts, getting the industry to act, and where we were really a facilitator. So we were pleased that we'd gotten the industry to move. It was unclear how much of an effect that would have.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something about the August 07 time frame when you're appointed to lead this task force. If you recall, a lot of stuff was happening in that month, not the least of which was both Countrywide's liquidity crisis, where they drew on the backup lines, and BNP Paribas. Do you recall whether that task force was before or after either of those events?
I do not recall. I think that they were not triggered by those events. Mm-hmm. It was much more triggered based on what we were seeing in the housing market, the default numbers that we were seeing, the foreclosure numbers that were starting to creep up. We wanted to try to get a sense of how big was the problem, and more importantly, what, if anything, could we do about it?
Right, and I think I know the answer to this question, but just so we have it on the record, what were the stresses and strains that Treasury was seeing in the housing market at the time?
Well, in the housing market directly, it's past dues. You know, how many people are 30 days past due, 60 days past due, 90 days past due. And then it's also, we were seeing real stresses and strains in the credit markets, and we tried to understand why were the credit markets starting to behave abnormally, and you peel back the onion, all signs were pointing back to housing and risk of, you know, what are these mortgage-backed securities really worth? Excuse me, what are these CDOs really worth? And so we needed to learn a lot about the mortgage-backed security market, how much visibility would we have into individual mortgages to really understand how bad the problem was and where the problems lied across the financial sector.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to the two initiatives you mentioned, the Hope Now and then the plan with investors and servicers to freeze rates, what was next?
We didn't know how big the problem was and how severe it would become. And our hope was that, you know, those people who bore the risk, both investors who made these loans or banks that made these loans and homeowners that bought homes, that we could allow the markets to function. And if someone took a risk, they should bear the consequences of taking that risk. So, you know, as I reflected on this, I think that we had that institutional bias of let's allow the markets to work, let's do less intervention, and to the extent that the government is going to intervene, let's intervene as a coordinating body. So Hope Now is an example of that. We concluded very quickly that the counselors and the servicers weren't talking to each other. They should be talking to each other. So we were a convening force to get them to work together, and they did end up working together much more effectively than they had been. When we froze the rates, that was not the government putting any money on the table. We were a convener of the servicers and the investors saying, hey, it's in your interest to avoid these foreclosures. Do what's in your interest. We were a convener. But all along the way, the markets were deteriorating, and we did not know how bad it ultimately would get. But it became clear to us that it was possible, though at the time not likely, it was possible things would get so bad that you'd actually have to put the federal government's balance sheet behind the financial system. And so in January, February of 08, that's when we began drafting what later became the Break the Glass Plan. If we really had to do something unthinkable, put taxpayer dollars to stabilize the financial system, what could we do? What would we do? And that's where we laid out those, whatever it was, three or four different options that we had in a very basic framework.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so as the market was continuing to deteriorate and you guys realized that, as you said, that you might have to put the federal government's balance sheet behind the financial system, what kind of analysis was being done of the various banks and investment banks and other financial institutions that were holding the various mortgage securities and other product?
Most of our analysis at Treasury, because we're not a banking regulator per se, so most of our analysis at Treasury was more done on the macro scale. How big is the mortgage market? What are the best estimates of loan losses in the mortgage space? What is the likely capital shortfall in the financial system? How does the financial system raise that capital to fill that shortfall? So the analysis that I was doing and that my colleagues and I were doing at Treasury was much more macro-focused than it was individual institutions. Yet we were in regular dialogue with the OCC, the FDIC, the OTS, and the Federal Reserve, and trying to get insights from them into what does this mean for individual institutions. But honestly, at this point, we were all quite surprised by when Bear Stearns came about in March of 08, the Bear Stearns situation happened. That the Bear situation, in my recollection, is really when we started focusing more on individual institutions. At then, it was more of a credit market problem. You know, if you may remember, the auction rate securities market froze. There was a fire burning, and it was showing itself in different credit markets around the world. And so we were more focused on markets at that point than on individual institutions.
Mm-hmm. So I've seen in some of the documents and of course some of the books that I know Mr. Swagel was one of the other individuals working with you at Treasury, but who else is on the team that eventually leads to the development of the Break the Glass Plan besides the two of you?
You know, it was mostly the two of us day-to-day within Treasury, although we regularly presented it to Paulson and eventually presented it to Bernanke, and we're sharing drafts of it with staffers at the New York Fed and the Federal Reserve Board. And so ultimately, I mean, it was a Treasury work product, but we felt that we had a lot of input from our colleagues at the New York Fed and the Federal Reserve Board in ultimately what became the final version of the Break the Glass Plan. I mean, and interestingly, when we finally finished it in April of 08, I later learned, you know, maybe a year later, that people at the Fed were quite surprised that Treasury was thinking this aggressively at that point in time. That I think we had all hoped that it would not come to this. And the fact that we were already thinking about what if the worst case scenario happens, apparently I learned later that it really surprised people at the Fed that we were being that aggressive. And they were much more hopeful that the markets would be allowed to correct on their own with the Fed just providing liquidity without needing any new fiscal authorities to intervene. And I think the reason we were thinking that aggressively is because we were doing so much work to try to help homeowners and seeing that the housing market was getting worse and worse and worse and that it may come to this.
Mm-hmm. So the document I've actually seen, the Break the Glass document, is dated April 15th, 2008, and I actually see it attached to an email that you send to, well, several people, including... Let's see, Meredith Broom, Gary Berner, Gary Grippo, Matt Abbott, Seth Wheeler, Garrett Overlock, Phil Swagel, Ted Gare, and Michael Schetzel, if I pronounced all those correctly. And it's the email where it says, you know, here's the current version. We are seeing Bernanke this afternoon with Hank to walk them through it. And my question is, you mentioned that this was being developed in I think started being developed in February and March of 2008. Were there earlier drafts that were prepared before this one, do you know?
There must have been. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure if you go into, Treasury has strict rules. I wasn't allowed to take any such documents when I left or any of my emails. So there must be, if you went to my hard drive at Treasury, there'd be probably version 16 and version
right.
12 and whatnot. But that I think the version you're looking at is the final version where Paulson and Bernanke both said, okay, this looks like a reasonable framework. The challenge is, the big debate we were always having is, if we needed this authority, how do you go to Congress and get the authority?
Right.
And if you send the Federal Reserve Chairman and the Secretary of the Treasury up to Congress and say, we're on the verge of the Great Depression, and then Congress says no, that could be so terrifying the financial markets that you precipitate the very crisis you're looking to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to go when you have maximum chance of actually getting the authority. So that document that basically went on the shelf and said, we hope we're not going to need it, but if the worst case happens, at least we have something to start with that we could go to Congress with. And remember, March 2008, we intervened with the Fed to bail out Bear Stearns and facilitate the merger with J.P. Morgan. April and May, markets started to rally again, and many market participants thought, hey, maybe the worst is behind us. Maybe Bear was the turning point, and it's going to get better from here. So at that point, when we put this on the shelf, we were, you know, maybe breathed a little small sigh of relief that we'd stabilized Bear, and maybe the worst was behind us.
Mm-hmm. But the, and again, just so I'm sure,
sure
that I'm clear and the record's clear, the fact that you're looking at this in February and March of 08 means that the concern with the deterioration in the market is pre-Bear, right? Bear is not
correct.
A trigger for...
Bear was not a trigger. It was, what if, you know, things keep getting worse. We keep getting surprised at how much worse things are getting. We're hopeful that the markets can deal with this on their own, and we're not going to have to put taxpayer dollars at risk. But what if the unthinkable happens, as has happened in other countries where the financial systems are on the verge of collapse? What would we do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Paulson asked to me and to Swagel. What would we do? What could we do? And that's why we pulled together the Break the Glass demo.
Right. Now, I've seen, not in the documents, but in, I think it was Sorkin's book, so I have to ask you to find out if it's true or not, that I guess before this April 15th draft gets done, he at least reports that, and I don't think he puts a date on it, but it was before that date, that, you know, you go to Mr. Paulson and say, look, we have to do this, or, you know, we're going to get criticized down the road if there's no record of us doing something, or words to that effect. I don't have the book in front of me, but do you recall what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the story in Sorkin's book is that I went to see Paulson, and I basically said to him, I was trying to be very provocative. Again, we were a Republican administration that believes in free markets, so we were reluctant interveners, and we wanted the markets to correct without putting taxpayer dollars or bailing anybody out. So I went to him and I said, the exact words that are in Sorkin's book, is I said, I see this clearly now, Hank. Obama's going to bring the hostages home. And the idea was, I wanted to kind of shake him and say, look, the next president, and I was being more provocative by saying it was a Democratic president,
mm-hmm.
is going to do what we know we need to do. And we're not doing it for ideological reasons. And how are you going to feel if the next president is the one that finally brings the hostages home? And it was a way of me being provocative to try to say, look, you know this too, that we're going to need to do this. And, it sunk in. My message sunk into him very quickly. But again, the question was, how do we get the legal authority? So even if we all agree, yes, we need to do this, how do we get Congress to provide us this unprecedented legal authority? Because if we go and ask for it and we don't get it, we're going to do far more harm than good. And so that was the calculus that, as I recall, that Paulson and Bernanke were always wrestling with, was how can we ask Congress for this authority?
Mm-hmm. So walk me through, if you can. I mean, again, I haven't seen this in documents, but I've seen it in Sorkin's book anyway, the description of the walkthrough meeting with Paulson and Bernanke, it sounds like, on April 15th or shortly thereafter. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, just to the best of my recollection.
Of course.
I mean, Phil and I were there with Paulson, and Bernanke was there and much of his staff. There was a cast of six or eight staff members who we worked very, very closely with, who were at the Federal Reserve Board, and they were all there. And we just said, look, you know, Mr. Chairman, Secretary Paulson had asked us, given us an assignment to figure out what are the things we could do. If we had to intervene in financial markets using new fiscal authority, what are the things we could do, and what do we think we would do and most likely do? And so we walked them through the pros and cons of all of the various alternatives. And, you know, as I reflected on this, because people have asked me many, many times, why did you switch from buying assets to injecting equity? Why didn't you just start with injecting equity? And, you know, the answer is, number one, and I'm jumping ahead, but we can come back.
Sure.
You know, we believe buying assets would work. We believe it was the right solution at the time, but we also believe it was the most politically palatable way of intervening in markets. And so if you have three or four choices of intervening in markets, three or four of which, all of them have the potential to work, you pick the one that you think is going to work that also has the advantage of being the most politically palatable. Mm-hmm. And buying assets is less, if you're going to intervene in markets, buying assets is a little bit less interventionist than having the government buy stakes in hundreds or thousands of banks in the country. And so as I've reflected on it, I really think that that helped shape the analysis that we did, that we ultimately presented to Paulson and Bernanke, and that helped shape, I think, why we went to an asset purchase program as our first best alternative, even though clearly in that document, buying assets is one of the options that's been identified.
Mm-hmm.
So we walked Bernanke and the staff through these alternatives, said here are the challenges, here are the upside of each of these, and here's why we think buying assets makes sense. You know, here are the new authorities that we need. Here's what we need the Federal Reserve to do. Here's the basic framework of how it would work. Now, to really figure out the details of how it would work, we would have to engage with industry participants because they're the experts who do this every day and whatnot. But we could not possibly go out to the industry and say, help us think about how to implement an asset purchase program, because then the markets would know what we're thinking about, and that would be terrible. So we did try to do enough work to paint a basic framework, but stop short of taking it a step further of actually engaging with the market to work through all the details, because we simply couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. What about at that time, was there any discussion with any folks from Congress, since ultimately it would require legislation?
Well, not about the Break the Glass plan itself. Mm-hmm. I know that Paulson was having many discussions, I mean, on an almost daily basis with bipartisan leadership. So, you know, Barney Frank and Chris Dodd and, you know, I'm sure Mitch McConnell and Judd Gregg, Bob Corker, et cetera, on what's happening in markets, what we had to do with Bear Stearns, what the future looks like, the emerging risks of Fannie and Freddie, which were, you know, beginning to start to show increasing signs of stress. And so there was repeated dialogue there. A lot of the message that I heard that he would get back from them is, interpret your existing authorities creatively. Many members of Congress said to him, you know, we actually had our lawyers, Treasury lawyers, going back through our statutes back to the 1800s, mm-hmm. I'm not exaggerating, looking for some statute somewhere that could be interpreted in, you know, 2008 that would give us the authority to intervene if we really needed it. And members of Congress would go back and tell Paulson, if you can interpret something with a straight face, we'll back you up. Just don't come up here and ask us for something special, because it's going to, you know, people hated what you just did with Bear Stearns. And so a lot of the feedback we were getting from Congress is what guided us to say, don't come up here and ask us for something like this until you really, really need it. We'd much rather you interpret something creatively and justify it after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we know that ultimately, both for the GSEs and TARP, Mr. Paulson went for new powers, so I take it that creative authorities through research didn't get you guys anywhere.
It didn't, and trust me, we tried. You could talk to Bob Hoyt, our general counsel, how many times he and his team of lawyers went, you know, combing through the statutes. We just couldn't find anything that we could interpret with a straight face that would give us the authority to do this.
What about, this is something that I don't know if you have any knowledge about, but what we saw in terms of Wells' purchase of Wachovia, and one of the things we did see was, you may recall, shortly after the city-assisted bid of Wachovia was announced on, I think it was September 29th, the IRS issued this notice, 2008-83, that apparently Treasury had been looking at for a couple of months. The purpose of which was to remove, you know, it allowed folks to accelerate the recognition of built-in losses so that you could shield income sooner as opposed to over time. That was eventually repealed or at least overturned. But that was done to remove obstacles from banks buying troubled banks. Do you recall anything about that IRS notice?
You know, vaguely, as a general matter, we were looking at every tool across the federal government's arsenal, Treasury, the Federal Reserve, the regulators, what tools do we have that could help increase the capital in the financial system or attract capital to the financial system or help strong banks acquire failing banks so that, you know, because we didn't have other tools to deal with it. And so I didn't work on that issue per se, but my recollection is it was pursued under the objective of, even if it's a small thing, if we can do it and we think it's going to help stabilize the financial system, let's do it, because we don't know how bad this problem is becoming.
Right. And the reason I ask, or one of the reasons I ask, is, you know, your comment that folks on the Hill were saying, you know, interpret your powers creatively, yet I will tell you there's at least stuff in the press, you know, after 2008-83 came out and after Wells purchased WaMu, and then I think that was also, you know, a benefit for the Nat City purchase and for another purchase that escapes me now. But afterwards, you know, there was some criticism and complaints that this was a violation of the separation of powers, and it was Treasury, you know, legislating when that's left for the, obviously constitutionally, by the legislative branch. And so I'm just wondering if you remember anything, given the message that you're also telling us that the Hill was sending, and that is interpret stuff creatively.
Yeah, I mean, what you just said, I'm not familiar with the details of these individual items, mm-hmm. but it is consistent with my memory that the Hill said, interpret stuff creatively, don't bring stuff to us. And then to the extent that we did that, what are you guys doing? You know, it's like, at the end of the day, we were doing something that was deeply unpopular and deeply unfair, right? We all believe in free markets. We believe that if someone takes a risk, they should get the rewards, and if someone takes a risk, they should bear the consequences. And yet we had to violate that core belief. And so at the end of the day, we had to do something that was really going to anger people and be deeply unpopular. And so, you know, I think members of Congress were reflecting what they were hearing from their constituents. So mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that that sentiment changed.
Right. Okay. Thank you. So then let's just continue through the year. After you walk Bernanke and Paulson through the Break the Glass plan in April of 2008, what happens next in the first instance in terms of the Break the Glass plan? The books indicate that it goes on the shelf and you guys don't deal with it again until September of 08 when things really fall apart.
That's true. It basically went on the shelf because, again, the question was, okay, we have a framework. When could we go to Congress? And the consensus of Paulson and Bernanke was, we can't go until we know we're going to get the authority. And we hope and pray we're not going to need it, but we can't possibly go right now. So it went on the shelf, and then that's really when attention turned to Fannie and Freddie. And I think at the time, some of my colleagues at Treasury were leaning very hard on the GSEs to go raise private capital. And they had made some commitments to do some, and if I remember correctly, Fannie actually did raise some capital, and Freddie didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, housing market continued to deteriorate. Fannie and Freddie were coming under increasing pressure in the capital markets, their stock prices were getting crushed, and then ultimately we had to run to Congress and ask for emergency authority to try to stabilize Fannie and Freddie. So much of our work over the course of the summer was focused on that, getting that legislation, and once we got the legislation passed, actually, you know, understanding how bad the problem was. Because one of the keys is the legislation gave, I believe it was the Federal Reserve, the ability to look at the GSEs in conjunction with the GSE's regulator, FHFA.
Right.
So it did away with FAO, or renamed FAO FHFA, and it gave the Fed a consultative role, because we were concerned that FAO or FHFA may not have the analytical tools they need to really understand the risk that Fannie and Freddie were bearing. So what Treasury encouraged and the Fed agreed to was have the Fed go in there. I think the OCC went in there too.
It did.
So I think it was the Fed, the OCC, with FHFA, and we hired Morgan Stanley as our Treasury's financial advisor to comb through Fannie and Freddie's books, and they spent about a month doing that, analyzing their entire mortgage, not just their balance sheets, their portfolios, but their entire guarantee book, to understand in different housing scenarios how big are their losses. And that's when it became clear to us that the firms were effectively insolvent and that we had no choice but to take them over either in conservatorship or receivership.
And let me ask you a little bit about the GSEs, but let me back up before we get to the post HERA, the Housing Enforcement Recovery Act, or whatever it was called, that led to the Fed and the OCC going in there. So on March 19th, 2008, there was a press release issued by, I guess then it was still OFAO, announcing a partial reduction in the capital surplus from 30% to 20% in exchange for a commitment to raise capital. And as you mentioned, Fannie subsequently did raise, I think, about $7.5 billion of capital. Freddie didn't. Were you involved at all in the negotiations that led to that deal that was announced on March 19th? I have not seen you in the documents that I've looked at.
No, that was really Bob Steele and David Nason and others in the Office of Domestic Finance.
So what role, if any, or what involvement did you have, if any, in terms of looking at the GSEs in the February-March 2008 timeframe?
Nothing. Okay. I mean, one thing I was involved in that we haven't talked about in March 2008 is Paulson sent me to New York to work with the New York Fed the Bear Stearns weekend, and so I spent the weekend there. And while I was trying to get that situation resolved with the New York Fed, Bob Steele and Dave Nason and Tony Ryan and some others at Treasury, I believe that same weekend were negotiating with the GSEs on, I think the timing lines up, on the announcement that you just referred to.
Mm-hmm. Right. So tell me, since you brought it up, what are you doing at the New York Fed on Bear Stearns weekend?
Well, Hank stayed behind. He was in D.C., and so, in a sense, I was his eyes and ears on the ground to try to assess, you know, what's the status of the diligence that the J.P. Morgan is doing on Bear Stearns? Are there any other buyers that are interested? And just coordinating the response. And so a lot of my time was spent shuttling between the New York Fed, J.P. Morgan's offices, and Bear Stearns' offices. And J.P. Morgan, you know, for most of the weekend was saying that, well, first they said that they were going to do a deal without any government assistance. And then they came back and said that, well, we've finished our diligence over the course of Saturday night, and we've uncovered these other loan losses, risks that we're not prepared to take. We need some form of government assistance. So part of what I was also doing was talking to our lawyers who were back at Treasury, again, combing Treasury statutes, looking for some way for Treasury to provide assistance, because any sort of assistance like this would clearly be the gambit of fiscal policy, not monetary policy. Mm-hmm. And so it's very awkward for the Federal Reserve to make such a loan. Although we knew legally the Fed could do it, it would have been much cleaner if Treasury were able to do it. So over the course of the weekend, again, we concluded that we did not have any legal authorities and that the Federal Reserve would have to use their powers to intervene, with some recognition that, you know, ultimately Treasury would bear the losses. If the Fed bore any losses, they would trickle through the Treasury. So a lot of what I was doing was just passing information back to Paulson and to the Fed, and, you know, answering questions. And then finally, when it became clear that the Fed was going to take a pool of assets from Bear Stearns, a $30 billion pool of assets, my job was to try to make sure we understood, to the extent we could in the course of a couple hours, what assets we were taking. And, you know, making sure that J.P. Morgan was not going to try to cherry-pick and just leave the taxpayers with the worst assets where they kept the best assets.
And were you dealing directly with folks at J.P. Morgan?
Yes.
So who initially from J.P. Morgan said they thought they'd be able to do a deal without assistance?
Jamie Dimon.
Okay. And do you know, and you mentioned that subsequently, I guess Sunday, I think you said that they had a chance to look more at the assets and said they do need assistance. Any more color or specifics on what the findings were?
All I heard, and I can't remember who told me that news, because I know that their diligence team worked throughout the night, and they, you know, they reported presumably to Jamie and to his management team of what their findings were. And then all I remember from Sunday morning was Paulson was doing a series of Sunday morning shows to talk about Bear Stearns and the financial crisis, and he didn't know the news that the deal was off. And so I remember frantically trying to get to him to inform him that the deal was off and that, you know, we needed to get to the Fed and figure out if there was a way to provide assistance. Otherwise, we didn't have a resolution for this problem.
Were there, I mean, just help me understand sort of the, I mean, clearly it was a surprise to Secretary Paulson that the deal went from, that the deal was off, or at least off unless there was government assistance. What were the discussions once that message was delivered from whoever at J.P. Morgan Sunday morning?
Then it was that the discussions were, okay, if Treasury doesn't have, at that point it was, we had not definitively closed the book on Treasury's authorities. So it was, one, making sure our lawyers had combed through all the statutes to see if there was any way Treasury could provide it. Two, you know, what the Fed would need to do and what they would need to be comfortable using their authorities, because as you know, the Federal Reserve Act requires them to be secured to the satisfaction of the board.
Right.
And so what they would need to be to meet that legal requirement to be secured to their satisfaction. And then what the actual assistance would be, what would be the pool of assets. And so that was a discussion back and forth. I believe it started out as a $35 billion pool, and ultimately I think it ended up being, if I remember correctly, a $29 billion pool, and there was a negotiation back and forth about which assets would be included, which would be excluded, and whatnot.
Were there any discussions with J.P. Morgan about, what do you mean you need assistance? We expect you to close this deal on an unassisted basis.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was Paulson and Bernanke and Geithner. That was their first, second, and third conversations. I mean, that's all they were leaning on J.P. Morgan, and J.P. Morgan was saying, we don't have to do this deal, right? We're not the ones asking to do this deal. You're asking us to do this deal, and we don't need to do this deal, so thank you very much, but no thank you. And, I mean, you know, we couldn't order them to do the deal.
Right.
It was up to them to decide to do the deal.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the same weekend, the government announced the primary dealer credit facility. Were you involved in that program at all, in creating that program?
No, I was not. I mean, I knew it was being created, but there was a team at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that was focused on that.
Okay. So then, as we move past bear, explain to me generally what's going on in the markets. On the one hand, a little earlier, you know, you said the markets actually came back a little in April and May, and folks were hoping that, you know, bear was it. So explain to me what's going on market-wise and what the concerns are in Treasury in, let's at least start out with, you know, the rest of March and April.
So the moment after bear Stearns was resolved, the markets turned their attention to the next weakest investment bank, and so that became Lehman.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if I remember correctly, around the same time, Dick Fuld came on TV with some, you know, reassuring comments, and I think they even may even have raised capital, and people thought, okay, Lehman is being pretty proactive about trying to address their problems, and they're being more transparent than Bear was. So actually, I remember that Lehman was getting some applause that they were trying to address their problems, but markets were very focused on Lehman. So while the markets in general got a little bit better, they breathed a little bit of a sigh of relief when I remember in April and May, I think Lehman was still coming under increasing pressure, and the housing market was continuing to go down. And, you know, foreclosures were increasing, delinquencies were increasing, mortgage-backed security prices, I think, were still falling. And so, you know, we were still very concerned that, although some people were optimistic that the worst was behind us, it's very well possible that the worst is not behind us.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that then in, you know, in April, you get the break the glass document done and present that, and it goes up. So take us through, you know, April and, you know, after the presentation to Bernanke and Paulson, and that being on the shelf for, if God forbid, you need to use it down the road.
Well, when I remember, May and June are kind of blurry for me, aside from Fannie and Freddie. There was a lot of work going on over the course of the summer, actually on Lehman. It wasn't me per se, but there was a team at Treasury, the Fed, and the SEC that were looking at Lehman and what to do if Lehman were to run into trouble. So I mentioned earlier that up until Bear, we were really much more focused on markets than we were on individual institutions. Once Bear happened, then we started to focus more on individual institutions. And so over the course of the summer, there was the team looking at what could the government do about Lehman, and if Lehman had to be unwound in some capacity, how could you do it? You know, what could the Fed do? Could the FDIC use their authorities over banks? And the conclusion was no, et cetera. And so there was preparation work done to try to do something about Lehman if they ran into trouble. In addition, we were doing, this is where the tax issue that you raised came out.
Mm-hmm.
We also had people within Treasury and all the regulators, again, combing all of our various tools. You know, could we, what if we ordered all the banks to cease paying dividends, across the board? How much capital would that add to the system, or would that preserve in the system? What are the tax things we could do? What can the FDIC do with their very broad powers that they have for banks? And so there was I remember it being a month or multi-month process where we were kind of coordinating a process with all of the regulators where everyone was looking at every tool they had to figure out, even if it's small, if we do enough small things, maybe it'll make a difference. And so that was also going on in the background. But I can't remember per se more about May and June other than that work and the Fannie Freddie work.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I've seen in the documents and heard from other folks that we've talked to is in this time frame, both Lehman specific, but I think even a little broader in terms of investment bank specific, was there seemed to be a heightened concern about the tri-party repo market, both in terms of the overnight investors possibly taking a walk, or of one of the two clearing banks, Boney or J.P. Morgan, deciding, I don't want to unwind, I don't want to provide intraday credit because there's too much mortgage product being financed through the tri-party repo market as opposed to just agencies and treasuries. Do you recall that, one, and two, were you involved in those efforts?
I recall it because that really came to my attention Bear Stearns weekend, because that's how Bear was running into trouble and losing their funding. And the contagion risk from Bear to Lehman to Merrill to Morgan Stanley to Goldman was the tri-party repo market, that the view was if Bear Stearns had filed for bankruptcy and not been acquired, that tri-party repo would, that funding source would dry up overnight for all the other investment banks, and then you'd have, a series of dominoes. They would all collapse in a matter of a few days. And so that, that's really when attention turned to that market from what I recall, but I was not involved in that. That was really driven by the New York Fed, mm-hmm. In terms of what we can do, if anything, to try to stabilize that market.
So another thing I've seen in the documents, again, another area of concern post-Bear, was in the area of OTC derivatives. But a difference between that was, of course, Boney and J.P. Morgan are providing tri-party repo market information to the Fed every day. But apparently, from what I've seen in the documents, there was not a whole lot of information on what the various derivative exposures were of the investment banks. In essence, who's going to get hit if someone goes down? Where are the dominoes going to fall? Do you recall that being concerned, one? And two, what was your involvement in it, if any?
There was some concern of that, and I think from what I remember, it was more around the Lehman situation as the SEC and the Fed and Treasury tried to look at what to do about Lehman over the course of the summer as Lehman came under more and more pressure. I think they did make attempts to try to understand what would the contagion effects be, what would the collateral damage be to their to Lehman's counterparties. I was not directly involved in that work, but I also am under the impression that they didn't have very good visibility into that.
Right.
And that, certainly once Lehman failed, it was clear to all of us that the markets had now become so fragile that they could not possibly withstand another shock, and that even if we cannot quantify the risk and knowing exactly what the implications are, if an AIG failed or if the Citigroup failed, we simply cannot possibly take that risk, because if the financial system collapses, it'll be so devastating for the American people that we just cannot let that happen. And so these are hard things to quantify, and part of it was just the experience of Paulson and Bernanke that they were relying on. But at some point, things got so bad that we just couldn't let them get worse.
Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like, once the Break the Glass plan is presented and put on the shelf to be pulled back off the shelf in September of 08, that your primary role at Treasury is looking at the GSEs. Is that correct?
Yeah, again, I was not the lead in that. So mm-hmm. My primary role at the Treasury was, I was involved, but not, I was not the lead person. That was more David Nason and then later Dan Jester. Mm-hmm. I was involved in that, but more working on all the myriad issues, saying, okay, what are the things we could get the FDIC to do? What could the OCC do? What if the Fed used this authority? What if other people used this authority? What if we ordered the banks to all stop paying dividends? I mean, we were trying to turn over every stone. And so I think over the summer, I spent a lot of my time trying to get people to turn over stones, to look, maybe there are other things we haven't thought of that we could do, while my colleagues took the lead in trying to stabilize Fannie and Freddie.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a little about Fannie and Freddie, even though you weren't the lead on it, because we've done some amount of work on those institutions. And again, one of the things, we talked about this a little, but one of the things we've seen is, you know, there was a, on the one hand, you know, pretty much from the fall of 07, the street was gone, and, you know, Fannie and Freddie were the only game in town in terms of providing liquidity to the secondary mortgage market. But at the same time, there was, I believe, concern about the financial condition of those institutions based, if nothing else, just on, you know, the size of the mortgage product owned or being guaranteed, combined with what to me at least appears to be pretty low capital requirements in the statute. So and I will tell you that other folks that we've talked to at Treasury or formerly at Treasury have told us, yeah, you know, we recognize that, you know, but we were basically faced with two lousy choices. You know, we had potentially financially unstable $5 trillion combined companies, but we also, they were the only game in town for the secondary mortgage market. What were the discussions about these issues or trade-offs, as then OFAO Director Lockhart used to say in his various speeches? You know, there's just a trade-off between the safety and soundness of the GSEs and their mission of providing liquidity to the secondary mortgage market.
Right. So that tension is exactly right. We knew we had a necessary housing correction. So home prices got way too high. They had to come back down. And policies to try to impede that correction were doomed to fail. We had to allow the markets to correct. But we didn't want them to overcorrect. And so if all finance to housing dried up, then we would face an overcorrection, because even people with real down payments and good jobs wouldn't be able to get financing to buy a home. And then whatever the losses would be in the financial system, they would be many multiples of that due to the overcorrection. So it was imperative that both Fannie, Freddie, and FHA be able to continue their public policy mission of providing finance to the mortgage market so that we could allow the markets to adjust in a more orderly manner without having a massive overcorrection. And so you're right. I mean, it was a tension. We were nervous about Fannie and Freddie, but what choice did we have? Because if we shut Fannie and Freddie down, in effect, then the consequences of the financial markets would be dire, because all of housing finance would dry up, and then there'd be a massive overcorrection of the housing market, leading to far, far greater losses. So we had to prop them up as best we could so they could continue to fulfill their mission. And we were pushing hard on FHA, too, because FHA is part of the federal government, is fully, you know, backed by the Treasury. Mm-hmm. So it was important that FHA stepped up, and they did.
Okay. As we talked about a little before, after that March 19th press release, Fannie raised capital, Freddie did not. Were you involved in any of the discussions with the folks at Freddie about, guys, how come you're not raising capital?
You know, I may have been, but again, I was not. I may have been in one or more meetings with them, but I was not in the lead. We were leaning on them, from what I recall, about as hard as we could to tell them to raise capital. And, you know, it was from what I remember, it was a combination of they couldn't, and they were in denial. They thought the stock price was too low, and obviously it would just go down from there. And that was a common problem. You know, many people didn't understand what a mess they were already in. And so they said, gee, why would I want to raise capital at this price? And, you know, the obvious answer now is, well, if you don't raise capital at this price, you're never going to be able to raise capital.
I've seen some reference in a couple of documents that one of the reasons Freddie may not have been willing to raise capital was simply because their lawyers were telling them it's probably not a good idea to issue a registration statement with representations in it because there may be questions about our reported financial results. Do you remember hearing anything about that?
I don't recall that.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean it's not right.
Right. So let's jump ahead then to, you had mentioned earlier that you know, once HERA got passed and the Fed and the OCC went into the GSEs, they found that the institutions were, I think you said, effectively insolvent. And, you know, I've seen the same thing in documents that those folks produced and in interviews with representatives of those two agencies, which led to the obvious questions for them that I had about, well, you know, what was the OFAO, FHFA people doing, and were you finding things there that they didn't find one. Two, were there disagreements between, you know, the conclusions that were being reached by OCC and Fed and what the OFA, OFHFA folks thought the condition was? Do you have any color on that?
Sure. It was an awkward position for the FHFA because they had very recently come out and said, they're meeting all their regulatory capital requirements. And I think the truth is, from what I recall, the regulatory capital definitions were set in statute, and they were a snapshot in time. The work that we had the Fed, OCC, and Morgan Stanley do was to look forward and say, okay, let's run through four forward-looking scenarios of the housing market and the economy, and what does it mean for losses? And so I think FHFA would say, look, they were somewhat restricted by Congress in terms of how they're supposed to define capital. They were not charged to always look forward, but we said, for the sake of the financial system, we need to look forward to see how big these losses are likely to be. And that's the difference, that the work that the Fed, OCC, and Morgan Stanley did, that's what was different than what FHFA traditionally had done.
And I will tell you that I've seen those points in documents and interviews, both that, look, given the way the statute was written, basically the capital requirement was hardwired. You know, they didn't have the same kind of safety and soundness powers that the banking regulators did to say it's not good enough, even if you are technically meeting the definition in the statute. Let me probe you a little further. I get that, and I get the difference between losses booked under generally accepted accounting principles and looking forward. But I believe I've also seen in documents and interviews that even with that the Fed and the OCC felt that the actual amount of loss reserves booked were not sufficient, or that, you know, the amount of impairment charges on securities were not sufficient, or that, you know, the deferred tax asset was impaired and needed to be written down, et cetera, et cetera. There appeared to be, from what I've seen and heard, some disagreements on the actual reported levels of capital between the Fed and OCC on the one hand and the FHFA on the other. Do you recall anything like that?
It's certainly possible. I don't recall it because I think that the forward-looking view was so bleak that these other differences were pretty minor in comparison to how big the hole was looking ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's certainly possible. I'm not pushing back.
Not here. I just want your best recollection. So let's jump then, since we're here in the chronology, to Lehman Weekend, or at least that's what everybody terms it. What are you doing on Lehman Weekend?
So just after the prior weekend, we announced the conservatorship of Fannie and Freddie. Mm-hmm. I then flew to, on Tuesday or Wednesday of that week, I flew to Asia, to China and Japan, to meet with government officials and major investors in Fannie and Freddie securities to explain the government's actions. So that, you know, we use this limited authority to provide, we use a limited congressional authority, meaning I can't remember how long the HERA authority was for, to provide indefinite support for the Fannie and Freddie. And we did it through some very smart legal maneuvers, frankly. You know, creating these preferred stock purchase agreements that are structured as securities. It was quite complicated how it all worked. It was all legally sound. It had been vetted through the Justice Department and whatnot. But it'd be very hard for foreign investors to really understand the level of support that we are now providing to Fannie and Freddie. So I flew to Asia to explain this and say, look, in effect, these entities now have the full backing of the U.S. Treasury Department, and you know, you should have confidence in the soundness of these securities that you hold. So I just got back from Asia. I can't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday of Lehman Weekend, so I was not in New York for Lehman Weekend, but got back to learn what a perilous state Lehman Brothers was in.
So let me, I should have, before I got to Lehman Weekend, asked you about the weekend that the GSEs were put into conservatorship. What was your role on that weekend and leading up to that weekend?
So, again, I was not the lead person in the Fannie Freddie situation and putting them into conservatorship. That was Dan Jester. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, involved and helpful and supportive and, you know, everything from working with people in the department to, you know, a plan to basically go in and, in effect, take over the entities and make sure that the trading systems, I mean, I wasn't doing the detail work here either. I was just involved. making sure that we had the new CEOs in place, making sure that people were behaving appropriately, making sure that the entities could continue to function. There was a lot of planning work. In addition to the legal work and the financial work, there was a lot of tactical planning work that went into actually putting these firms into conservatorship. And so I was one of the team members that were on and around this process, even though I was not leading it.
Mm-hmm. So when you get back from Asia that Saturday or Sunday, I think I heard you say that you weren't in New York for any part of Lehman Weekend. Is that accurate? Okay.
That's accurate.
So are you, once you do get back, are you involved with either Lehman or AIG or Merrill Lynch, I suppose, at that point?
No, because I got back Sunday, and then, I mean, that's Sunday is when I recall Paulson said, we need to go to Congress. Because I think he thought at the point that Barclays was going to buy Lehman. And even if Barclays had bought Lehman at that point, we knew at that point that we thought that after we stabilized Fannie and Freddie, that we bought ourselves some time. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'd be a month, maybe it'd be 3 months. But there was such a profound intervention, stabilizing a huge part of the financial markets, that would buy us time. We were surprised that Lehman then happened, you know, a week later, that Lehman had to be taken over or it would go into bankruptcy. And so that's, I think, when Paulson called and said, okay, get ready to go to Congress, because we're going to need to go. And I think that he and Bernanke had talked about it. So that's when I got back Sunday, it was, you know, talking to my colleagues, our general counsel and others, okay, what do we need to go to Congress with? And I remember that that's when we took it off the shelf and said, okay, at least here's a starting point. You know, let's move forward from here.
So walk me through what's next then. Because obviously we know that Lehman files bankruptcy on the 15th after the Barclays deal falls through. Merrill gets acquired by B of A. I don't know the exact date, but I know the initial 3-page plan gets shot down and the markets tank. And eventually it gets approved, I think, the following week. And in the interim, you know, we've got investment banks becoming bank holding companies. We've got WaMu going down and Wachovia, you know, at least initially being bailed out, but then Wells comes in. So maybe walk me through what you're doing, and then specifically with the, you know, dusting off the break the glass plan to go to Congress.
Sure. So we hoped that Lehman would not, when Lehman filed for bankruptcy, we hoped it would not be nearly as bad as it was, because the markets had seen it coming for 6 months. And Paulson Bernanke, I'm sure they said this to you, you know, they looked at their legal tools. They didn't have the legal authority. The Lehman did not have adequate collateral for the Fed to lend against. No one could invest equity, so there was no way to prevent Lehman from happening. Nonetheless, we hoped it would turn out better than it did. And so that was Monday. By Wednesday, you know, our phones had switched from ringing from financial companies calling us saying they were in trouble to blue chip industrial companies calling us saying they couldn't fund themselves. And that's when we were, you know, terrified that the worst was happening, that the financial system was collapsing. And that's when we said, okay, we're going to Congress tomorrow. So Thursday, September 18th is when we actually went to Congress, had the bipartisan meeting with both houses of Congress, the leadership of both houses, and that was Thursday evening. So along the way, it was almost constant dialogue with the Fed, with Bernanke, with Geithner, talking about the status of markets, talking about what we need to ask Congress for, talking about what else the Fed could do. Ultimately, we had to go get approval from President Bush before we went to Congress and asked for that authority. We went and got that approval on Thursday, and Thursday evening is when we went to present to the leadership of both houses. So that was Thursday evening. Then they asked us for the draft legislation. I think we sent over the draft legislation, if I remember correctly. It was Thursday the 18th. Friday night, the 19th, very late at night, is when we finally sent over the 3-page document, which is really just a description of the legal authorities that we would need. It was not actually meant to be a complete bill. Obviously, that's not how it was interpreted. I then spent the next 2 weeks basically living effectively on Capitol Hill, explaining to the staffs what we were asking for, what was at stake, what else was happening, explaining to members of Congress, explaining to senators, and then negotiating the detailed legislation. The very interesting thing was that, you know, Wachovia happened while we were up on the Hill. Mm-hmm. And the FDIC, as you noted, used their guarantee authority to guarantee a book of assets. I can't remember how big the book was that they were guaranteeing for Citi to take over. Was it? I think it was $300 billion.
It was $300 billion, with Citi going to cover like the first $40 billion of losses.
Right. Yeah. So that happened. It was remarkable. I remember this. And many staffers and many congressmen and senators, both parties, said to me, what crisis are you talking about? Wachovia just got acquired by Citigroup. Where's the problem? And I looked at them like they were out of their minds. I said, do you realize that the FDIC, in the stroke of a pen, just deployed whatever it was, $260 billion of power? We're asking for $700 billion. And it just occurred to me that people had no idea what was really happening, what the FDIC had just done, and how serious the situation was, because people said, wow, the FDIC acted, everything works fine, you don't need us. And what I was saying to them is, you don't get it. The FDIC squeaked one by here. That's not a play that we can run over and over and over again. We absolutely do need you. And it was so remarkable to me, because we've been so deep fighting the fire for so long. We were living it every second of every day. And yet, you know, Capitol Hill, and no criticism, they were just too far removed to really understand how perilous the situation was.
Mm-hmm. So were you involved at all in either the WAMU or Wachovia events?
No, I was informed when they were happening and that they happened, but I spent all of my time on the Hill trying to get the legislation done.
Okay, and again, I suspect the answer is the same, but the week before when Goldman and Morgan become bank holding companies, you involved in that?
No.
Okay. So you're up on the Hill for these 2 weeks following Lehman's bankruptcy, through the investment banks becoming bank holding companies, through WAMU's failure, through the systemic risk exception for Wachovia. So just take me through it. After you have this meeting, after Wachovia is saying, you guys don't get it, you're out of your minds, what next?
It was just continual negotiations. Ultimately, it all came down. I can't remember the date. It's in Hank's book. Mm-hmm. There was a Saturday meeting with Hank and myself and Kevin Frommer and Judd Gregg on one side, and then most of the Democratic leadership, House and Senate, on the other side, negotiating the details of the bill. And the bill came together over the course of that Saturday and Saturday night, and we had a handshake deal around midnight Saturday night or 1 a.m. Saturday night on what the basic structure of the bill would be. And then we spent the next few days with the congressional staffers actually turning it into legislative text. And then the House voted it down the first time, whatever it was, you know, November or September 30th or whatnot, and which I think was a Monday or a Tuesday. And then a couple of days later, the Senate voted for it, and then the House came back and voted for it after the Dow had dropped 700-plus points. And then I think the final bill was signed and turned into law, if I remember correctly, on Friday, October 3rd or October 6th. I can't remember the date.
I think that's right. I think it was the 3rd, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay. And then after that, I believe, and again, I forget the date, but then there is the meeting where the various folks are told to come to Washington and told they're going to take TARP money. Were you involved in that?
I was. That was later. That was a few weeks later. So I think it was that Friday that the bill was signed that Paulson asked me to run the TARP. And so the next few weeks I spent building, you know, Treasury is a policy department. So year in, year out, Treasury does economic analysis. It doesn't have any investing operations to speak of. So we had to build the Office of Financial Stability from scratch, and we had no idea how big and how complex it would need to be at the time. I think when we were negotiating legislation, I thought we'd need about 20 people to administer it. We ended up needing about 150 people, at least when I left in May of 2009. We had about 140 people, many of whom were in compliance and oversight and whatnot, not just the core investing functions. So I was busy trying to set up the organization from scratch and get the asset purchase program going. Meanwhile, markets were deteriorating devastatingly fast from beneath us, and we decided we needed to put capital into the banks. So one of the teams I had was working on designing what the capital program would look like, and so I was very involved in that. And then ultimately, you know, Paulson called the 9 banks in, he and Bernanke, Geithner, and we, you know, delivered that message, and then they obviously accepted.
Can you walk us through that meeting? Because what we've seen from both in interviews, documents, and the books are different reactions to the message, whether the message was, we want you to take TARP money, or whether the message was, you're going to take TARP money.
Well, it was, we want you to take TARP money. And, you know, first of all, I mean, coming from the Secretary of the Treasury, the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, the President of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the Comptroller of the Currency and the chair of the FDIC, when they're all delivering that message, we knew it was hard to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And that was by design. And we had just learned from the British, who were trying to put capital in their banks, that some of their banks said, no, we're not going to take capital. And the problem is, for any financial institution, all financial institutions exist based on confidence. And they don't want to do anything that's going to make them look weak or undermine confidence. So taking any form of government assistance will make them look weak. And if one bank says, no, I don't need it, every other bank is going to raise their hand and say, hey, I don't need it either, even if they in fact do need it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was important for us that we had unanimity that all of them were going to take it, so that none of them could say, I don't need it, and then everyone else would play that same game of trying to pretend that they don't need it. So having them all take it was important to us,
mm-hmm.
Number one. Number two, the message was, we want you to take it. And by the way, you know, so I think it was Wells Fargo that pushed back the hardest, Dick Kovacevich.
Mm-hmm.
And Paulson said to him, let me be very clear. If you don't take this, and you later need to come back and take it, you are not going to be happy with the terms you get. And so we designed the program, because of the stigma of banks taking government assistance, we intentionally designed the program to have reasonably attractive terms so that they would want to take it, even though, you know, for other reasons they would try to resist. And so he said to him, he said, look, these are reasonably attractive terms. You should want to take this capital. And if you don't take it and you come back because you need it later, you're going to be very unhappy. And so, I mean, the truth is it was an offer, but it was an offer that was hard to refuse.
Right. Okay. So let me back up a little. I forgot to ask you one thing. When you're up on the hill, or actually when you come back from Asia and Secretary Paulson says, dust off the break the glass plan, and then we get eventually to it being passed, walk me through how the decision is made to, it's best to directly put equity in banks as opposed to buy securities.
Well, that decision wasn't made till later, after the legislation was passed. We intentionally, you know, the crisis, one thing that was constant about the crisis is that we were always behind. The crisis was always worse than we had expected.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always morphing and manifesting itself in ways we didn't expect. So we knew we'd get one shot at this authority, and it was important that we provided ourselves maximum firepower and maximum flexibility. And so we specifically designed the authority to allow us to do basically whatever we needed to do. So if you look at the definition of troubled assets, this is where the real flexibility is. The definition of a troubled asset was any mortgage or mortgage-related security or any other security that the Secretary of the Treasury, in consultation with the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, deems as important for financial stability. All right. When you say any other security,
right,
that means you can buy anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was done intentionally because we didn't know how much worse the crisis would get, and we didn't know how it would flare up in some way that we had not expected. And so that flexibility was key. So we designed that flexibility on purpose, even though all of our intention and focus was on putting capital into the banks. But if you were to, I don't have the data in front of me, if you were to look at, for example, the LIBOR-OIS spread for the last few years, and look at what happened in the few weeks between when Lehman failed and we ultimately put capital in the banks, effectively the financial system had a heart attack. And, you know, the analogy that I use is that imagine going to the ER to have your leg operated on. The doctor's operating on your leg and you have a heart attack. Well, you hope that the doctor forgets about your leg and goes in and stabilizes your heart. And that's literally what happened. The U.S. economy, the financial system had a heart attack. And so while right after the legislation was passed and we're busy trying to set up the asset purchase programs, markets deteriorated so quickly from beneath our feet, we had no choice but to pivot to something that was a much more aggressive shot of adrenaline right into the heart of the financial system, and that was putting in capital.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, I mean, can you walk us through any discussions that there were with folks on the Hill about that change and whether that created any issues with them?
Honestly, I don't remember. We were working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I was so busy trying to get the programs built and the office built that congressional liaisoning was probably taking place, and that would have been Kevin Frommer, head of legislative affairs, with Paulson, consulting with Barney Frank and Chris Dodd and the Republicans, et cetera. But I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm. So does The direct infusion of equity into the banks, is that what finally calms the markets?
It helped a lot. I mean, that was not the, we didn't know the all clear sign, but if you just look, for example, at that LIBOR OIS spread, so two things we did that same day, direct injection of banks, and then the FDIC created their guarantee program for bank debt.
Right.
Those two things in combination ended up being very powerful tools to try to restore confidence and to quell the panic that the markets were facing at that point. And so that was a key milestone, but it did not signal all clear yet, because soon again, AIG reared its ugly head, Citigroup ran into trouble, needed more help, B of A needed more help, we had the auto companies, there were many shocks yet to come, or risks for the economy.
Mm-hmm. So then once the direct equity infusions are made and you're dealing with the subsequent shocks, just walk me through until you leave in May of 2009.
Well, October, November, December was spent, and January was spent dealing with, so I had teams working for me, dealing with Citi, dealing with AIG, dealing with B of A, trying to set up the capital purchase program. So we announced those nine banks, but we created a program that literally thousands of banks across the country could apply for. And we needed to create a standardized process for them all to apply. So this was a massive undertaking, all happening in parallel, mm-hmm. as well as trying to deal with the auto companies. So, you know, my time was spent building the operation. My time was spent making sure that the Citi intervention was on track, the B of A intervention was on track, AIG was on track, the autos were on track, and the basic capital purchase program was being set up and executed appropriately. You know, in some cases at its peak, we were making 50 investment decisions a week. And so it was just a massively complex undertaking that we were trying to build from scratch. So it was all-encompassing and it was exhausting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I expected to conclude my service with the new president coming on board, having been a Bush appointee. But there had really not been much of a transition to the new administration. And so Secretary Geithner asked me to stay for a while to help until they could get their new team in place. I thought that would end up being a few weeks, and then it ended up being about 4 months. But I was glad that I stayed because I helped to provide continuity, because the TARP was only kind of three quarters built at that point, mm-hmm. and we needed to make sure that it was fully built and fully functioning. And so, you know, I continued to administer it, and there was yet another Citi intervention, if I remember, in right. February or March that I was involved in. I was not involved in the autos once the auto task force was set up. I mean, I had to approve their disbursement of TARP money, but I was not, you know, day-to-day involved in any of the details of their decisions or the way they structured their interventions. And then, you know, by May, we had turned the corner. The stress test results were coming out, and my successor was now in the building, and I was able to do a seamless transition to Herb Allison.
Okay. Great. So in November, in terms of AIG, November of 2008, I know that that's when $40 billion of TARP went in there as part of a program that also involved the previous $85 billion New York Fed credit facility being reduced to $60 billion. And then those Maiden Lane 2 and Maiden Lane 3 transactions were done at the same time. There may have even been another part, but it's escaping me right now. I suspect you were involved in the $40 billion TARP part of the program. Were you involved in the other initiatives?
No. I mean, that was just part of the package that the Fed was pulling together. You know, we all, at first, you know, did not want to use the TARP for AIG, because we said, look, the TARP is a finite authority. We want to preserve it for broad programs to help the financial system. The Fed has already dealt with AIG. But the Fed came back to us very hard and said, look, what we have done is not working. At the end of the day, this is a capital problem. And as much as we try to dress liquidity up, you know, taking different forms of assets as collateral, we cannot solve the capital problem. Only Treasury has the legal authority to solve the capital problem. And so that's why they convinced us that, you know, they were in fact right, and we really needed to do this to try to stabilize AIG. So it was with great reluctance that we did it, but we did it in consultation with the Fed because we thought it was the right thing to do.
Okay. You probably know that the Fed has received more than a little criticism for the Maiden Lane, really the Maiden Lane 3 transaction. because everybody says, oh, you paid the investment banks, you know, 100 cents on the dollar when you factor in the collateral payments they received previously. Any views on that?
Well, I mean, the point of a bailout is to bail out everybody who's owed money by the firm.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So why bail somebody out if you're, you know, you may as well just let them fail. So it's like, I don't get the criticism. I mean, I get the criticism politically and emotionally. I don't get the criticism substantively. You know, at the time, again, we were terrified that the financial system would collapse. Blue chip industrial companies couldn't fund themselves. Think about that. They can't make payroll.
Right.
So even Americans who have jobs don't get their paychecks. And they can't pay their rent. They can't make their car payment. It cascades through the economy. And the Great Depression scenario was omnipresent as we were in this time, in the worst of the crisis. And so, honestly, our highest priority was preventing the financial system from collapsing, and we did not know if we were going to succeed in doing that. If we could do that in a manner that was more efficient for the taxpayers, we would love to do that and you know, preserve taxpayer money, absolutely. But our first highest priority was preventing the financial system from collapsing. And if we were penny-wise, pound-foolish, by, well, let's haircut this or let's haircut that, and it ends up triggering a collapse, the taxpayers are going to be far, far, far worse off if we allow the system to collapse. And right. So I understand these criticisms now in the benefit of hindsight. At the time, we were just desperate to keep the system together.
Mm-hmm. What about Citi? I mean, what were the problems, particularly since they got a second slug? What were the problems that you guys were seeing in Citi generally? And then two, we've heard from some folks that when Wells came in and actually, you know, snagged Wachovia with the quote-unquote unassisted deal, and that Citi didn't get it, that actually had, you know, a negative impact on Citi, because even though Citi was acquiring that troubled bank, there was a belief that Wachovia would actually help shore up Citi's financial position.
I mean, it was. We were looking for as much dry powder in the federal to put the federal government's balance sheet behind the financial system. And here was a chance for the FDIC to use their powers to deal with a couple hundred billion dollars of bad assets in the financial system. So from our perspective, the FDIC using their authority rather than having to use the TARP authority, which is by definition finite,
mm-hmm.
that was a good thing. Because it was another tool in the arsenal, in the federal government's arsenal being brought to bear. Now when Wells Fargo jumped in and said, well, hey, you know, we're strong, we don't need any assistance. Now those bad assets are no longer on the federal government's balance sheet, they're back in the financial system. And we wanted to get as much bad stuff out of the financial system and as much capital into the financial system as possible to try to stabilize it. And so it was, in my judgment, I wasn't involved in it. Mm-hmm. In my judgment, it was a mistake allowing Wells Fargo to do that, because it was taking support out of the financial system when we were looking for every way we could find to put more support into the financial system.
Let me think about that for a minute. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I've talked to some other folks that have at least wondered, at least, if not said absolutely, that we were concerned that a Citi-Wachovia deal might just create a bigger problem.
I mean, maybe, but if the FDIC is guaranteeing the $250 billion of mortgages, or what is $260 billion of mortgages, mm-hmm. it's a problem for the FDIC. And again, at that point, in those months, we were trying to get as many problems out of the financial system and onto the federal government's balance sheet as possible, because we didn't think the financial system could withstand it. And we were right. They really couldn't withstand it. That's why we had to do all these things.
And is it fair? I mean, that, of course, begs the question, but maybe this is just a matter of timing on letting Lehman fail. And I hear what you're saying about, you know, the lack of legal authority. And then, of course, we've heard that from folks at the Fed, too. But is, I think maybe what I'm hearing from you is that perhaps Lehman was at least the last straw where you folks realized, all right, you know, we can't let any more institutions fail. We need to prop these things up.
Right. Well, we need the legal authorities to not allow them to fail, which did not exist before Lehman. But keep in mind, even if there had been a way to interpret legal authorities creatively to stabilize Lehman,
mm-hmm.
that would not have stabilized AIG. That would not have stabilized Merrill. That would not have stabilized B of A, Citi. It was like we've been doing this Band-Aid one Band-Aid at a time. We finally ran out of Band-Aids. But the point is, even if we found one more Band-Aid, it would not have been the heart surgery that we needed to fix the problem. And we needed Congress to give us the authority to do the massive surgery.
I know you're on the Hill that the 2 weeks following Lehman's bankruptcy, but I still want to ask you, of course, WaMu was allowed to fail, and it went down Thursday the 25th, and from what we've seen, apparently triggered the run on Wachovia on Friday the 26th that then led to that deal over the weekend. Do you recall hearing about or being involved in any discussions about whether or not WaMu should be allowed to fail or whether or not the systemic risk exception should have been invoked for them?
Yeah, I was not involved in it. I think from my recollection that this was a battle between Treasury and the FDIC, and the Fed and the FDIC, where I think the FDIC, I mean, my recollection is the FDIC often wanted to be seen as being tough. And we were saying, that's great, we can all be tough, and we can, you know, be so tough that we plunge the financial system into the Great Depression. And so I think, you know, in my judgment, that was a mistake. In my judgment, at that point, the economy was in such a perilous state, it was like playing with fire. You know, WaMu is not Citibank. I agree with that. But at this point, when the risk of getting it wrong and the risk of allowing the financial system to collapse is such devastation for the American people, that is a dangerous game of roulette that you're playing. And so I wasn't involved in it, but in my view, we should have found a way to either allow somebody to acquire WaMu pre-bankruptcy or invoke the systemic risk authority, and we should have allowed the Citi Wachovia deal to go through with assistance.
Okay. So let me now just sort of ask you the more higher level questions that we've been asking everybody that were in positions like yours. What do you see now that you've had a chance to sit back for a little while since your 18-hour days? But what do you see as what were the primary causes of the financial crisis?
I think two primary causes, although the many, many, many contributing causes, but two primary causes. One is, for the last 30 years, our economy has taken on more and more and more and more debt. In some sense, the analogy I use is that we took on so much debt that we eventually had the inevitable obesity-induced heart attack. And we ran to the ER and had emergency surgery to stabilize the heart. The good news is we didn't die. Now the bad news is we're all lying there on the table and we're still obese. And there's no magic solution for all that debt. And it's going to take time. So number one is we just took on way too much debt as a country. Mm-hmm. Number two is fundamentally we had a nationwide delusion that home prices only go up. And 99.99% of Americans, myself included, shared in that delusion. And so when people ask me, well, how come regulators didn't see it coming? Or how come the investors didn't see it, or the rating agencies. It was literally a shared nationwide delusion. And imagine, I ask people, imagine if Alan Greenspan in 2005 had raised his hand and said, hey, I see a housing bubble. We're going to clamp down on mortgage lending. How would the country have reacted? People would have been outraged. Members of Congress would have been outraged that deserving Americans were being prohibited from participating in the American dream. And how is it that, you know, minority groups that want to be first-time homeowners, they're being restricted. There would have been massive blowback. And so as I look at it, it's very, very, very hard to be the one wise man in a sea of fools because there's such pressure because all the people who share in that delusion think that you're wrong. And yet we as a country believe this thing. And unfortunately is we're likely to repeat it. I don't know if it's 50 years from now or 100 years from now, but there will be some other nationwide delusion that we all participate in, and we're convinced that it's right, and it'll end up being wrong, and it'll lead to, you know, catastrophic damage to our economy. You know, the thing is, all of these risk models, everyone likes to talk about risk management. Risk management is the business of identifying risks, what can go wrong, understanding the consequences of what happens if it does go wrong, and understanding how likely it is to go wrong. Well, everyone had very sophisticated models, but all these models were predicated on the assumption that home prices only go up or they don't go down across the country. And no one or very few people ever thought to even question, should that assumption be embedded in our models or not? And so, unfortunately, when you have this nationwide delusion, it can lead to very bad things. You know, and in this case, it did.
Mm-hmm. So let me push back on that a little,
sure.
Given what we've heard from some other folks, and frankly seen in the documents, and some of this is just straight public information. We've certainly heard what you said from many people, but we've also seen, and a lot of this is public, you know, that there were plenty of warning signs, and that there was a recognition that, you know, the rate of increase in house prices in the decade of the 2000s, in the decade from 2001 forward, you know, was a much higher level of growth than had been seen, you know, in the previous decade since the Great Depression. That's one. You know, two, you know, unlike at least before the 90s, at least, I think, you know, there was this huge explosion in non-traditional mortgage product, the 228s, 327s, you know, lower FICO scores, negative AMs, high LTV ratios, et cetera. And yet, you know, sure, perhaps in the past you hadn't seen nationwide declines in home prices, but you certainly saw regional declines in home prices. And you certainly knew these two points, you know, that the rate of growth was much higher than before, and that you had all this other loan product out there that, one, there wasn't a history on, and that, two, even though there wasn't a history on, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out if somebody's qualifying at a 1% rate and there's a reset 2 years later that gets you up to 6, 7, 8% or whatever it is, that person's not going to be able to pay that loan, and if they can't refi the loan or sell the house, there's going to be a problem. And several folks, you know, have made that point to us that have said, I don't know what the heck the Fed was doing, because all of this was well known, and they could have and should have done something, like either raise rates or earlier issue the non-traditional mortgage guidance or enforce HOPA laws, et cetera. How do you respond to those types of comments that we're hearing from folks?
Yeah, I wish it were that easy, that we could just demand that our regulators all be wise, you know, but it's not that easy. And the people who are saying that, you know, the vast majority of talking heads out today who are claiming that they saw it coming are full of it. Very few people actually saw this coming. And the pressure that was brought to bear, if you did see it coming, was immense. I mean, did you read the book, The Big Short?
I did, yes.
Okay, so the one gentleman, one of the hedge fund managers, the guy who's off by himself, how much pressure, he saw it coming, he was making the bet, and yet his investors were going crazy that he was taking such an unorthodox bet that went counter to everything that they believed in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so easy in hindsight for all these people to say, oh, it was obvious at the time. It was not obvious at the time. If it was, those people who were saying that wouldn't have bought a house in 2005. All right, but they did buy a house in 2005 because they thought that home prices were at least to stay flat, if not continue to go up. And so, you know, I wish we could legislate wisdom and just say, guess what? From now on, every chairman of the Fed is going to be omniscient. But unfortunately, that's not reality. That's not life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I don't know what else to say other than, you know, let me say this. Look at the tech bubble. All right, people said, well, we clearly have a tech bubble. All right, should the Fed have gone in and somehow clamp, raise interest rates to try to pop the tech bubble? Well, the tech bubble raised, it revealed itself, and it burst, and there wasn't that much damage to the economy. In a sense, that bubble was okay to let it expand and let it burst because it didn't trigger catastrophe. Now, the housing market ended up triggering catastrophe, and it's terrible, and I wish we could have prevented it. But I don't know how you prevent these things and know that you're right. You know, because right now someone is undoubtedly raising their hand saying that there's a crisis brewing in some market somewhere. And so should the Fed go try to quash that market somewhere because somebody somewhere is saying it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very hard. It's like trying to predict terrorism. You know, the CIA, I'm sure, gets tips every day of an impending terrorist strike. Well, unfortunately, I think we all know that at some point there will be a terrorist strike in our country again. Heaven forbid, but it probably will happen. And I'm sure someone's going to say, oh, I called it. I gave the CIA a tip. Well, the problem is when the CIA is getting hundreds of tips a day, how do you know which are the right tips?
Right.
And yeah, in hindsight, it's all obvious. But at the time, it's not obvious.
Do you have any views on, I mean, one of the things I've noticed, too, is that you had the tech bubble burst, and at least the immediate direct impact on wealth was somewhat similar to the impact on wealth when the housing bubble burst. But as you pointed out, the systemic impacts were very, very different. And any opinions on why that is?
Yeah, it's a couple of reasons. One is, I don't remember the total dollar value of the tech market, let's say market cap, but you know the mortgage market in America is something like an $11 trillion market, residential mortgages. So it's a huge, it's a much bigger asset class as a percentage of total wealth in the economy. And then number two, leverage. Most people owe, you know, have 90% LTV on their homes or 80% LTV or whatnot. So the fact that people are borrowing money to take this out means that that huge debt component makes this a much more devastating problem when the markets adjust. So if the tech market drops 10%, people's equity adjusts 10%. When the housing market adjusts 10%, you know, many people are wiped out and they have no equity left, and now all of a sudden they have to just pay back this big loan. And so the addition of leverage is what makes this problem so much more damaging.
So when you mentioned the two primary causes that you saw of the financial crisis, I think before you listed those two, you said there's many other type, you know, causes that don't fit your big two. What are the other, you know, lesser causes that you see as part of the crisis?
Other lesser causes are government housing policy, encouraging, you know, affordability and focusing on home ownership, you know, Democrat and Republican saying we need to get the home ownership rate up. That was clearly a contributor. The dual mandate of Fannie and Freddie of shareholder profits and public policy objectives was clearly part of the problem, allowing them to get so big with their balance sheets, which don't serve any real purpose other than driving shareholder profits.
Right.
That was clearly a contributing factor. Runaway complexity that people didn't fully appreciate, you know, in mortgage-backed securities, in CDOs, in CIVs, off-balance sheet structures like CIVs where people said, oh, it's not really Citigroup's problem if it's off-balance sheet, but then at the end of the day, they have to take it back on balance sheet because of reputational risk. That's clearly part of the problem. I mean, again, many things were just risks people didn't understand were actually there. And this goes back to my point of it, you can't legislate wisdom. People didn't understand how risky overnight funding was because it had never blown up before. And then when it blows up, everyone said, oh, wow, it really is risky, but no one had ever appreciated that. So, you know, the too big to fail problem is probably one of the biggest vulnerabilities in our financial system that was exposed by this crisis. And it's a fiendishly difficult, complex problem to try to deal with. And, you know, in my judgment, we still don't have a good answer for it yet today.
Right. Let me ask you another question on TARP, if I can.
Sure.
And towards the end of 08, we've looked at this whole B of A Merrill Lynch transaction, and, of course, that deal gets negotiated over Lehman weekend. But then from what I've seen, at least, you know, you've got the – as you get into 4Q08 additional losses rear their ugly head at Merrill, and we've at least heard from some of the folks that were involved that you know, B of A came to Paulson and Bernanke and said, look, there's more losses here. We're thinking about invoking the material adverse change clause, and they said, no, you're not. But we, the government, will help with TARP. Were you involved in any of that at all?
Loosely, I was. I mean, I was on a few calls with B of A. And certainly a few calls with the Fed, but again, we had a team that was dedicated to that, and I was kind of monitoring their progress, but not the guy doing the day-to-day negotiations.
Okay. 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 Mr. Kashkari, thank you very much for your time. I very much appreciate it. I don't have any more questions for you.
Okay. My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.